Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to find he's in Georgia on a cell phone. We have had a hard time getting a connection with our guest this hour, so bear with us. We hope to have Paul Salopek here momentarily. He was last with us 1 year ago, and he has an extraordinary story to tell. If we don't get him on the air, at least I'll guide you to our Facebook page where you can see what he's been up to. But we're hopeful that we will be able to reach him for our conversation this hour. Paul is spending 7 years tracing our ancestors' trek from prehistoric African Eden to the Middle East and Asia, and then crossing into North America and heading south. He started the walk in 2013, so he's been walking for over a year and a half now. It was started in humankind's birthplace in Ethiopia, and it's going to end up at the southern tip of South America. Every 100 miles, Paul is recording a narrative milestone. He's taking gorgeous pictures of the ground and the sky and the sound at the location, and also a brief interview with the nearest person. Check out his pictures and his reflections because they are really astounding. Once a year, National Geographic magazine is publishing a full-length feature story, and this year it is the December issue out now, the cover story, Blessed, Cursed, Claimed, On Foot Through the Holy Lands. So we urge you to follow his incredible journey. So go to our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you'll be able to link to all of his writing, his pictures, his video and audio. And the walk that he's taking is also shared in real time with thousands of school children all over the world. Paul is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winning writer. He's worked as a foreign correspondent in Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia and Latin America. He was born in California and raised in Mexico. And no luck finding him. You know, it's not the kind of thing that I can talk about my walk around the world with you because I haven't walked around the world. But he's seen some remarkable things. And this contrast of the way people first migrated all that distance and what he's seeing now, because he's traveling with mules and camels carrying all his goods. And he gave us this memory walking along highways with camels through Saudi Arabia. The surreal reality of it, he said, in some cases, walking with camels by a Pizza Hut with Saudis inside eating pepperoni who look outside and see a skinny American with camels. He is the first outside journalist to walk through Saudi Arabia since 1918. So with all that said, I hope that we'll be able to find him wherever he is in Georgia at the moment. We did this last year, and it worked out just swimmingly. The connection, I mean, we could have been next door, and he was in Africa when we last talked to him. So we hope that we'll be able to establish connection momentarily. So let me just tell you before we go to an open line here, because that's what we'll have to do. Tomorrow during this time period, Korean War veteran and prolific historian Stanley Weintraub will join us. He's been here before. He has a new book, Christmas Far From Home, an epic tale of courage and survival during the Korean War. Stanley is also the author of Silent Night and Pearl Harbor Christmas, and it's a narrative of a wartime Christmas season, and Stanley fought in the Korean War as well. So it's one of those forgotten wars, and he will talk about how brutal it was, and major figures like Harry Truman and General MacArthur and the Chinese fighters, and how American soldiers just were absolutely freezing. So that's coming up tomorrow during this hour. All right. All I can do is, because I can't talk all hour, is to give you our phone line. And it's been forever since we've heard from you suggestions for programs, because we've had so many programs that we want to do. And I know that KP and Scotty are both trying to land Paul, but we're having a hard time doing that. So we will go to phone calls and, you know, come up with terrific suggestions. And maybe your suggestion will be on the air, and maybe we'll be able to reach Paul sometime during this hour. We're just going to have a kind of unexpected hour. Here's our phone number for you to give suggestions for programs. And they're always good. We don't do these very often, but today is the chance because we don't know where Paul is. So here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to give suggestions for shows. And, you know, I kind of like Facebook. I think you know that. But you can always leave messages for us on Facebook. And if you wonder what it is we're up to, if you like our page, then we will be able to give you updates of what the upcoming shows will be. And it's always wonderful. I read those. Every time I'm off the air, I read the comments that you've made about various shows. So use it for that as well, because then it's a true community discussion about issues. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we're just going to do an open line here, getting show suggestions, which we haven't done in forever, and we hope that somewhere along the trek in Georgia, Paul Salopek will be able to join us. George in Madison, thank you for saving me, George, if you're there. Hi, George.
Hi, Kathleen. I enjoy your program very much, and I listened last hour. I realized that it would be wonderful if you could do a show sometime that had to do with propaganda face every day as citizens in the U.S. Your last guest spoke so much about how the voters have been reacting to the news that's coming out of Washington, in particular in their own state houses, and I mean, it would be nice to hear an analysis of why they hear that type of news. What's the source of that news, and who benefits from spinning stories certain ways and to believe it's not an accident that they vote the way they do. It's not just what they hear. Mm-hmm. And the political ads that are put forward are so dumbed down. I'd like to hear a discussion about that someday. We're more intelligent than what we're given credit for, and it would be nice if you'd have an expert speak to that sometime.
All right, George. Thanks very much for your call. Yeah, the shows that we do on how we get our news are always shows that generate a whole lot of response from you. And I think George has a valid point that we're not seeing the kind of investigative reporting that we used to see. Why isn't that the case? Are we being fed stories that people want us to hear in a way that's beneficial to them? So it's a good idea. And we like doing those kinds of shows. George, thank you very much for your call. And let's go next to, is it Julia or Julia in Oshkosh?
Yes. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I was wondering if I could propose the following topic for future conversation, and that is the joy or benefits or hazards, however you want to see it, of raising an only child versus multiple children.
Okay. Is that what you're doing?
Yes, I am.
I suspected that might be the case. And is
I am the youngest of six, so I've seen kind of both sides to it.
Uh-huh. So do you have how old is your child?
My child is 9 and a half.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I've read a lot of books about the benefits, also the concerns, et cetera. And, you know, there's a good argument for and a good argument against.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it might be a nice topic of conversation.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks, Julia, for your call. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? It benefits of in large families as well, or no children, or we can go in many directions for that. Frank in Onalaska. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Thanks, Kathleen. Always an excellent host and show. I'm sorry you don't have this current topic.
I know. I was looking forward to him.
Yeah. My suggestion is the controversial American Transmission Company's consortium of utility companies that want to build electric power line grids across the entire state of Wisconsin. The major question here is they haven't demonstrated need, and they want the ratepayers to pay the entire cost, guaranteeing a 12% rate of return to these electric companies. It's one of many areas pending in front of the Public Service Commission right now. If they win this case, they're going to build this one of 16. This particular one would run from the La Crosse area down to Madison. And anybody who's been through the Southern Madison Beltline 12 and 18 area knows these 120-foot towers are an eyesore, maybe a health hazard, and certainly not something that electric company customers should be paying for.
Okay, Frank, and if you have suggestions of guests, if you want to send them our way.
There's a lot of pro and con. The energy companies, of course, they're spending a lot of money, including contributions to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really waiting to hear this topic because, you know, I've kind of got some doubt that their money interests are winning out in terms of the battle of silence.
All right. We're on it, Frank.
Thanks.
Thanks. Thanks very much for the call. Valerie in Appleton, hi.
Hi there.
Hello, Valerie.
Hi there.
Yeah, go ahead.
Foggy out here on Highway 10. I am absolutely addicted to Simon Sinek, and I would love to hear him on your program.
I'm sorry, who's Simon?
Simon Sinek?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know him.
Oh, I think he calls it the power of why. He's one of the top TED Talk speakers.
Okay.
And Iyanla VanZant, I think she'd be real fun to have on.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that, Valerie. Who was that?
Iyanla VanZant.
Okay.
I think she'd be real fun for you to interview.
All right, so Simon has written a book, The Power of Why?
Yeah, Simon has written, I think he has a new one out called Why Leaders Eat Last.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Very good.
All right, good. Well, you've taught me something new. Thank you, Valerie.
Thanks.
Uh-huh. Goodbye. Caitlin in Madison, hi. Caitlin, are you there? Caitlin is not. Judith in Wausau. Hi, Judith.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
Well, I'm all right. How are you?
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. Go right ahead, Judith.
Yes.
All right. How are you?
You'll want to turn your radio down.
It's down.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. I would like to suggest a program in which you might bring in experts or researchers on the huge explosion of human population on the planet. And while you've done programs on how that affects other species and such, I'd be curious to know what factors affect population growth and population decline and how government plays into that.
Okay. Yeah, it's been a while since we've devoted an hour to that topic. We do look at it tangentially, but it's a good idea, Judith.
Yes. Well, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Judith.
Have a good day.
Thanks. You too. And our next caller is in Alias in Milton.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? I just have something that I was thinking about that may be a conversation or a topic or something you guys might want to talk about is how the technology in our school system is affecting our children's motor skills. I've noticed that since now that they've introduced a lot of iPads and et cetera into their classrooms, my children's handwriting skills are actually going down.
Oh, yeah. Okay, and they've been doing all those reports. I can feel it, too, in my neck. Can you feel it? I was realizing that you look down at the iPad and the phone, and your neck, at the end of the day, your neck hurts, doesn't it?
Well, no, yeah, I've always had not very good handwriting skills myself, but I've noticed that now that I have my, you know, my phone, my computers, my
right.
et cetera, when I go to write a note or send a message and everything like that. I can barely even read my own handwriting now.
Oh, no.
So, I mean, it's just, I think that the more we're using these devices, the less our actual simple motor skills are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know my dad always used to say about his few people in his family, I have horrible handwriting too. Oh, she has a fine hand. It was always women who did for some reason. She has a fine hand. And I don't think anybody says that anymore because we don't do that anymore. You know, we just type everything.
And I just, I don't know, I just thought that'd be a good topic or something that, you know,
right.
what other people
okay.
think and felt.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea. Thank you very much for your call.
Yep. Uh-huh. Thank you, Mike.
Okay. Bye. Ruth in Madison. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I would like, as the legislature is preparing to turn us into a right-to-work state where other workers shouldn't have to pay for the benefits they receive. I would like to have a show on what benefits the legislators have given themselves that we pay for that we don't receive even. You know what I mean? Because if you receive the benefits and shouldn't have to pay for them, if you're paying for them but don't even receive them, we should at least know what they are. So I would like to have a show on the legislators' benefit package. And, you know, even like, for example, their sick leave, that they get sick leave, but they never have to actually take their sick leave. They just call it a work day that they're working from home. So they accrue all this sick leave, and then they get to cash it out for health insurance after they retire, things like that. And I just think that if they're going to try and take it away, benefits away from people through the crushing of unions, they're going to take away benefits that people are receiving that they're actually paying for. They should themselves should give up the benefits that they aren't paying for that we are paying for.
Okay, Ruth, thank you very much for the call. And concerning the unions, I wanted to do a show on history of unions in Wisconsin and right-to-work states, and there are a lot of states that have gone that route, so I think we ought to do a show on that, which we probably will, but probably not until 2015. Isn't it amazing? It's almost 2015, until 2015. Thanks, Ruth, for the call. I think that we have located Paul, and he's going to be calling in. We're just waiting for him to call our studio line, so that should be coming up. Those of you who want to take this trek around the world, Paul should be on his way. Howard in Maple Grove. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Howard.
Hi. My suggestion is as a follow-up about Christmas stories during wartime.
Uh-huh.
The Christmas Truce of 1914.
Yeah, it's a great story, isn't it?
That's my favorite Christmas story, and I'm a pastor and a hospice chaplain, and I share that story every year during the season of Advent.
Oh, do you have it in story form, Howard?
I just kind of, threw it from the heart. But
okay.
There's a film called Joyce Noel, which is a dramatization of the Christmas Truce.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, the soldiers and the nationalities, the Germans, the Scottish, and the French, go back to that no man's land and have a soccer match.
Oh, do they really?
Remember the Christmas Truce.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, we should do a little show on that. We don't have time before, but actually our guest tomorrow, who's written the book about the Korean War during this time, wrote Silent Night, which is about what you were just describing. He first came to my attention many years ago when he wrote that book. But we'll have to do an update about how it's commemorated. That would be an interesting, just a little short thing that we could do during one of our hours.
Yeah. A good story of hope during the season.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Howard.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Bye. Let's go next to Don in Oshkosh. Hi, Don.
Hello?
Hi, Don.
Yeah, my suggestion is to get somebody in from the Circus World Museum and talk about the early circus days up to the present. And it's very, very interesting subject.
All right. All right, Don. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
bye.
Thanks. Bye. Tony in Green Bay. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Tony.
You do a great show.
Thanks, Tony.
The thing I'm calling about is these thermal paper receipts that we get at the grocery stores and everywhere you go. And there's some real danger issues with those, and they're made by one of the mills down in Appleton.
Mm-hmm.
They've done research on this and found out that it can cause problems, especially with women. And one of the things they just found out is that using hand sanitizer actually increases the rate of absorption of the BPA in these receipts. They had a show on Science Friday recently about this, and they talked to an endocrinologist, Frederick Vom Saal, S-A-A-L, who's written a new study about it.
And tell me I know what they are, but it's escaping my mind right now. What's a thermal paper receipt?
Oh, like if you go to the grocery store and they print out your receipt and they hand it to you.
Right.
Or you go to the bank or, virtually everywhere.
Right.
The library, any of those. And I'm not sure if it's I think it's everything connected with it, the paper as well as you know, whatever makes the stuff appear, if it's, I don't know if it's ink or a photo process or what.
But, I see.
There are some major problems that they've discovered with this.
Mm-hmm.
And considering the closeness because of its Wisconsin ties, it seems like an issue that really needs to be studied.
Right. All right. Thank you, Tony.
Okay.
Thanks. We did make contact with Paul, and now we're just waiting for him to call our studio line, which he evidently hasn't done yet. So might just be because heavens knows where he is. He's in Georgia. I mean, I don't mean Georgia. I mean Georgia. And he is walking. So we hope that we'll be able to link with him. But what we're doing is an open line while we're awaiting his call. 800-486-8655 is our number. Kurt in Springbrook. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to hear you talk with a guest about community rights and local control, have local governments being able to say no to corporate harms like frac sand mines and transmission lines and stuff like that.
Okay. And is there one issue that you're particularly concerned about?
Frac sand mines, definitely.
Okay.
Communities in the central part of the state aren't able to say no to them. I mean, the corporations have, they're enshrined as constitutional rights, and they have more power than the local communities trying to say no.
Mm-hmm. All right, Kurt.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Robert in Beloit. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
Hi.
First off, I wanted to say I'm a huge fan of the show. I listen to it every time it's on.
Thank you, Robert.
Second, I wanted to bring up a point. A gentleman not too long ago was talking about curriculum for schools and the iPads and electronics we have nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed in my child's school that cursive handwriting is not in curriculum anymore. And I've done some research, and I've noticed that there are, I believe I might be wrong, but 40 states now that do not do cursive handwriting in their school curriculum for elementary and middle school.
Really?
Yes. And my son, I first noticed this when I asked him if he was learning it, and he asked me, well, what is cursive handwriting?
Oh, my goodness. I didn't even know this. Well, how are you supposed to learn it?
Well, that's the thing. We've been teaching my oldest son now here at home, but I did some research and noticed that there are actually a lot of states that do not see it as necessary, and they don't teach it.
Well, you have to learn how to write your name, don't you?
That's what I said, is you would think you would need it for your signature at least.
Right.
So I thought that was interesting. I figured that would be a good suggestion for something to talk about.
It is indeed. I had no idea that was going on. Thank you, Robert. We'll investigate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Elaine in Colfax. Hi.
Hi. There's something that's happened in western Wisconsin. A Hmong man who's 64 was beaten severely when he was hunting. He accidentally went onto someone's land, and the man attacked him. He had a lacerated kidney. He's in the hospital. He's in bad shape, but he did not die. But I think this is similar to what's gone on in Ferguson and New York and even the Trayvon Martin case, that someone who's different is thought of as a criminal, or, you know, their impression is that they can take them out with impunity. And this is being prosecuted, and I would like a whole program about this, if you could do it.
When did this happen, Elaine?
This happened during deer season, just in the last month.
Okay.
And there was a Hmong protest that went to a small town in, I think it was Mondovi, maybe in error about which town the Hmong, it was 250 Hmong people protested this beating that this elderly man took.
Elaine, if you have a newspaper account that you can send to me or alert me to, we'll look that up. I don't think I've seen a press thing in this part of the state about it.
Yeah, there's the Mutual Hmong Association in Eau Claire,
okay,
and La Crosse and Wausau,
mm-hmm,
and also the Eau Claire Leader Telegram would have numerous articles about this.
All right, the Eau Claire Leader Telegram. Okay.
Yes.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Uh-huh. And I believe we have Paul now, so we will pause for just one moment and Paul is walking. I think he's in Georgia right now, and I told you all about him, so we won't waste time with another intro. Just he's on the road. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Paul Salopak, we have made phone connection with him now. I just want to alert you that we did this a long intro earlier, but if you go to National Geographic, no, if you go to our Facebook page, the Kathleen Dunn Show, you'll see some incredible photos that Paul has taken, beautiful script, challenging ideas, as he's already been on his journey for a year and a half. It's going to be a seven-year journey, and I believe he's joining us by cell phone, obviously, from Georgia. His story is in the, one of his stories, December issue of National Geographic, which looks at walking along a river of raw sewage that foams in torrents from East Jerusalem, and he'll talk about plans to clean that up and what it may do to help create peace in the region. Paul, hello.
Hi, Kathleen.
Oh, Paul, there you are. Where are you, Paul?
I'm talking to you from the capital of the Republic of Georgia, Tbilisi.
Uh-huh. I'm so glad we made connection with you. The work you've been doing is just extraordinary, Paul. All the people that you've met and the pictures that you've given us, it's just, what a trek you're on, sir. It's just remarkable, isn't it? From your end, it must be really remarkable.
Yeah, it's been a humbling experience and an illuminating one. I've been very lucky.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the December issue of National Geographic, because it looks at a part of the world that's been so troubled. And I didn't even know about this. You write about this river of raw sewage that foams in torrents from East Jerusalem, 12 million gallons a day. Tell me about that very small part with a large issue of your long walk.
Well, it just seemed like a good metaphor for both the problems and potential solutions for a region that, as you point out, has had many, many, many generations of difficulties in terms of security. And what it basically is, it's the raw effluent coming out of East Jerusalem, which is primarily the place that Arab Israelis and Arabs from the Palestinian territories live. That's a disputed part of Jerusalem. And it flows out of that corner of the city into the desert and then spills into the Dead Sea. And it creates a health hazard. It's an environmental problem. And it just has not been able to be effectively resolved, partly because of the political problems in that area. That is, it flows out of an area of Arab residents into an area of the West Bank, a Palestinian Authority. It crosses Israeli military ranges. It goes through this checkerboard of political control that defines this part of the world, and so therefore nobody can plan how to clean it up. There's an archaeologist named Abner Gorin who is trying to work with his colleagues in the Palestinian territories to try to use this sewage flow as a vehicle to make peace between all the sides and create basically a green corridor that people will then walk and hike on, kind of a pilgrimage route, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And yet there was more violence a couple weeks after you were there, which, as he said, set those efforts back sometime.
Yeah, I mean, when I was walking in that part of the world, it was spring and summer of this year, and that was just before the latest Gaza war exploded. So things, it's two step forward, one step back.
Mm-hmm.
That's an old story in this part of the world, and yet the people, there are individuals with remarkable, persistent visions of peace who still toil through all of these episodes of violence, hoping that there can be some rapprochement sometime in the future.
Mm-hmm. Paul, tell me about some of the amazing graveyards. You write about Bronze Age graveyards that contain dead so old and unloved that they hardly seem human anymore. You've seen some markings of really, really early human civilization.
Yeah, well, this area of the world is one of the most ancient migration corridors anywhere on the planet, right, outside of Africa, because it is, in fact, at the geographical doorstep of East Africa, the place where Homo sapiens evolved. So as Homo sapiens spread out of the mother continent, there's, you know, the time frame that's still in dispute, that say 60 to 100,000 years ago, way back in the Stone Age, they had to go through the Middle East. And, you know, there are different theories and different data that show that they might have gone down along the southern rim of the Arabian Peninsula. Other people say they walked up the Nile corridor into the Levant, into what is today, you know, Israel and whatnot. And so I rewalked portions of this ancestral trail, and, you know, you stumble across Neolithic sites, you know, that go way back to the Stone Age, all the way up through these graveyards you mentioned, where there are thousands of dead buried on kind of mesas overlooking the Jordan River Valley. And some of these were the first cities that ever were born way back in the Bronze Age, in the Fertile Crescent.
Goodness.
And the problem that I saw going on there was there's a tremendous amount of looting going on, and there were archaeologists using drone technology to try to document it.
Mm. Tell me about the hospitality of the people you've met along the way. Would you say on the whole during the last year, people have been welcoming to you, or do they wonder who the heck is this skinny guy with the mules or the camels?
Both. I think they wonder who is the skinny guy with the camels or mule, and they're nonetheless hospitable. I think, you know, the thing about the walk and the thing about anybody who travels, you know, one of the things that strikes you, and it's one of the reasons why I think we travel, is that generally the gesture that's offered is an open hand and not a fist.
Mm.
There are some incidents where I'm walking through a tense part of the world. So
yes.
There were incidents where I got shot at. There were incidents where, you know, there were some misunderstandings, but they were a minority. The vast majority of the time, people gave me the benefit of the doubt and listened to what I had to say, and then often invited me to their homes. So it was a reaffirmation of our kind of relatedness. We are, in fact, one big giant family.
Mm-hmm. I know that you obviously couldn't walk through Syria, but you met so many Syrian refugees. One man, I think you wrote about, who'd been living in a cellar for something like 4 years. Tell me about the extent of the numbers of Syrian refugees in Turkey now, and how they're living, how they're getting along without being able to be in their own country.
Well, Kathleen, you put your finger on probably the meta story of the last year of walking. You know, the first year of walking out of Africa into Arabia was kind of high adventure and a cultural experience and a great privilege to walk through landscapes that had not been traversed on foot by outsiders before for many, many years.
Mm.
The second year is much more sobering. Moving into the Middle East and then into Asia Minor, into Turkey, I bumped into some of the most intractable, complicated wars going on today in the world. And also, by extension, the largest mass movements of people fleeing institutional violence in the world. So there are now, up to 10 to 11 million people displaced in the Middle East, primarily by the detonator of Syria's civil war. And I started bumping into them in southern Jordan, where they were picking fruits and vegetables for a pittance. I was staying in their tents. And then I bumped into them again in enormous numbers on the Turkey-Syria border. In fact, witnessed one of the largest mass exoduses in the world since the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something like 100,000 people crossed the Turkish border in 72 hours. So it's very sobering, a very sobering human landscape of turmoil to be moving through on foot.
Mm-hmm. Are there other areas? Have you had to change your route at all, Paul, considering all the upheaval in that part of the world? Afghanistan?
Well, not yet. You know, I haven't reached Afghanistan.
No.
That's still ahead. But I think leaving Africa, the Horn of Africa, from the very beginning, this walk has kind of been blown sideways and zigzagging through the geopolitics of the 21st century. And, you know, the irony, of course, is that 60,000 years ago when our ancestors walked this route, there was no such thing as politics. There were no artificial boundaries called borders, political
mm-hmm.
borders. They had different things to contend with, like glaciers or predators. But I'm running into abstractions, figments of the human imagination called a political border, and they are proving just as difficult to cross as a glacier. And those are countries that will not issue me visas, so I have to walk around them or I take a ship around them. And in the case that you're citing, Kathleen, I had to take a cargo ship from Israel to Cyprus to get around Syria, and then another ship from Cyprus, walked across Cyprus, and then took another ship to Turkey. And so now I'm way north up in the Caucasus. Hopefully, I'm going to be getting a visa to walk through Iran. That'll be in the spring.
Hmm. And you've found so many interesting guides. The guides seem to almost perfectly match where you are and what you need to learn about during the time you're there.
Yeah, well, they do. I mean, what's, you know, one of the wonderful things about this journey is that a lot of it cannot be planned. When you're moving at 3 miles an hour, it's very difficult, especially because the pace of your journey is determined by the things that you can't control, like the weather or wars or your own physical exhaustion. I can't tell people I'm arriving at your town or city on exactly 5 o'clock on Tuesday.
Right. Right.
So, you know, the truth actually is that the guides have been all found by sheer luck almost. This is a journey of serendipity where I've walked with tired Saudi generals. I've walked with Ethiopian nomads. I've walked with Israeli singers. I've walked with, Turkish photographers. It's just sort of that's one of the great wonders and the great joys. I don't know who I'm going to be walking with. They just have to be as crazy as I am, basically, set their own daily life aside to say, yeah, I'll walk across my country.
And speaking of pretty wild ideas, how in the world did you come up with this idea, Paul? This is no small thing you're doing.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm asked that, as you might imagine, with some frequency. And I think the idea, my answer, and it's an honest one, is that this isn't really a departure from my normal life to go, you know, lay aside a career in foreign corresponding to walk across the earth. It's an arrival, because I've been doing this my whole professional life.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a foreign correspondent, I used my body often. I like to work alongside the people who I'm covering to learn about their daily life. And I covered Africa for more than 10 years, and because of the lack of infrastructure in rural Africa, it often means you have to walk. So, you know, I've been sort of doing this project in piecemeal way for a long time. It just gelled that maybe why not then just string all these assignments together into one long linear assignment that lasts 7 years. So mm-hmm. It's not that extraordinary. It's something I've been doing my whole career.
I was struck, this wasn't, I don't think, in the last year, but I was struck by this image you have of, you know, you're walking, because you've lost weight, you're walking so much, you're walking through Saudi Arabia, I believe it is, and you're looking at a pizza joint. What is it, Pizza Hut or something? And people are inside are having their pepperoni pizza, the Saudis, and they're looking at you out the window, this guy who's got a couple camels with him, who's a skinny Westerner. I mean, what? Talk about kind of a jarring juxtaposition of modern life and the way it used to be. Do you run into that kind of thing often, or are you all so off the beaten track that it seems kind of normal to be walking around with a mule and a camel, and that's what you see?
Yeah, a little bit of both, and I think that's one of the great things about the storytelling, that it's, you know, there's this, it's a very human landscape that I'm moving through. You know, I used camels in Saudi Arabia because I'm walking, and I don't like carrying stuff on my back.
Right.
It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't like walking with a support vehicle either. So the best thing to do is just find people who are using the technology of not so long ago. We're talking our grandfather's technology, when they used camels as cargo animals in Saudi Arabia. So it wasn't that hard to find, you know, somebody who knew this technique. But with, you know, the incident that you're describing is one of the delicious ironies of this. It allows sort of you to look into this Alice in Wonderland looking glass mirror, where modern Saudis are probably among the most urbanized people in the world. And I write about this. I don't write romantically about the Bedouins, because there are almost none left
mm-hmm.
in the deserts of Saudi Arabia, because that would be a misrepresentation of reality. I write a lot about the cities of Saudi Arabia and urban life. But it is true. I mean, I'm using an old technology, so we have modern Saudis sitting in an air-conditioned Pizza Hut looking out of a refrigerated window at an American who's using their grandfather's technology to move through what looks like a freeway through Los Angeles. And that allows for a lot of interesting ironies and cultural sort of reflections.
And do you, I know that there are so many different things you could concentrate on when you're taking a walk or a trek of this magnitude. Are you looking at loss of rainforest? Are you looking at changes in temperatures, loss of ice, loss of snow? Is all of that a part of the journey, Paul? recording that?
Yeah, I'm writing. Yeah, issues like huge meta issues, global issues like climate change are definitely one of the main strands weaving through the storytelling. But I'm not really doing it in the way that you're describing, where I'm like a climate scientist going out and taking measurements. I considered that. I considered putting a little antenna on my head and, you know, wiring myself up with a thermometer and all this stuff. And I decided, you know, that's not what I do. Kathleen, we have enough data in our lives. In fact, we have too much data. We don't know what to do with it. We're awash in data.
Right.
We're missing meaning. And the way that I achieve meaning in my small little way is by storytelling. So I'm not going to go out and measure my footsteps down to the last, you know, nano inch. I'm not going to measure climate change the way scientists do. I'll measure it through the way that most humans do, which is by telling each other a story on their porch about how the crop failed last year, or about how their animals are dying because the grasses didn't come.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that imbues all this massive information that we're awash in with in this age of information with meaning. And that's what this project is about. Mm.
And do you have enough human connection, Paul, to keep yourself from going a bit mad?
I would turn the question around. I am, you know, the world is filled with people, and I'm bumping into them constantly. So, you know, this is the Anthropocene, what scientists call the age of humanity. But the biggest factor affecting the world today is not geology, it's not earthquakes, it's not volcanoes. It's like in the past, it's human beings. It's a species that is spread across the world and that is pushing aside the other part of the biosphere because it's using it in a technological society. So it's very difficult in today's world, outside of the poles, to not run into people. And you can have a big discussion about whether that's a good or a bad thing. I happen to like people. And this project is all about people. It's about being passed from hand to hand across borders, languages, and cultures to try to show how we're different and individual, but how we're also interconnected.
Mm.
And how what Kathleen does in the U.S. in her daily life has tiny ripples that are felt in the Horn of Africa and vice versa.
Mm.
And so it's the opposite of going mad by being alone. This is an accompanied journey. In fact, it's a collective one. It's one we're all walking.
Mm.
We realize it or not.
Yeah. We have time to take a couple phone calls for Paul. I'm sure he would love to hear from you. It's a connection, human connection from people in the Midwest. He's in Georgia right now. He's been walking for about a year and a half. We had a wonderful conversation with him a year ago, and you will find the current issue, the cover story of National Geographic this month, is about part of Paul's journey in Jerusalem, and very interesting observations of traveling past Bronze Age graveyards and meeting hundreds of thousands of Syrians in a shelter beneath a UN canvas in Jordan. He's on a 7-year, 21,000-mile journey, which is truly remarkable. So here's how you can talk to him if you would like. We just have a few minutes, and I hope the cell connection continues, but we'll go as long as we can. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Paul Salopek is our guest. He is tracing our ancestors' trek from prehistoric African Eden to the Middle East and Asia, then crossing into North America, heading south. He will finish the trip in 2020. Amazing. So join us, won't you? We'll take a few phone calls or messages. You can do talk@WPR.org. And please go to our Facebook page because you can figure out all the ways that you can see the pictures from Paul's journey and read his beautiful writings about this journey. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Paul, I think that our audience would be interested in how you're dealing with just what happens to the body physically. When I last read, I think you had only had two blisters. Is your body, are you really, really, really skinny now? And is your body holding up okay?
Luckily, I've inherited the great, tough hillbilly genes of my grandparents.
That's great.
I'm doing fine. I'm probably as fit as I've ever been in my life. Walking is a great exercise, and it's not too extreme that it, you know, breaks you down badly like running or some other activity. So I think I'm actually, I have no complaints, no more blisters since we last spoke, and I'm pretty good at climbing flights of stairs now.
Yeah, I'll bet you are. And what about the mules? I know that every now and then you have to stop to take care of the mules. They may have ice on their hooves or something like that.
Yeah, in Turkey, I've been using, as you might imagine, I've had to switch from camels in the Middle East to if I'm using pack animals, to using mules. And I need to let readers know that I'm not using animals all the time. When I walked across Cyprus, I used a backpack. When I walked through the West Bank, I used a backpack.
Mm-hmm.
But in places where it's not too outlandish or too out of the norm, in rural landscapes where these animals are still being used, I use them because it's simply much more pleasant and I can focus on the work of writing. So I've been using a mule. In fact, the next dispatch coming up on the National Geographic site is about this mule. And it's she's been great. She's walked with me for about 1,300 kilometers. That's about 800 miles.
Oh, my.
Great job.
Oh. Let's take a few phone calls for you. Jeff in Madison is calling in. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, I just wanted to encourage you there in Tbilisi on Rustaveli Street. There's a very tiny, ancient, very old gold museum, and down in the basement you'll see a picture of how they pan for gold in northwestern Georgia. They do it with sheepskin stretched across streams, and it makes you realize that when Jason sailed with the Argonauts in search of the Golden Fleece, he was actually headed to what's now northwestern Georgia to probably steal a gold-flecked lined sheepskin. So you should stow the mule for an afternoon and go to the Gold Museum. It's well worth it.
That sounds great, Jeff. I'll take your advice. Yeah, this crossroads is ancient, not just Jason, as you mentioned, classical storytelling from Homeric times, but the Amazons, the legend of the Amazons also came from this part of the world, the Black Sea, the Scythians. So I'll have a great time digging into this mythic past.
Mm.
Thanks for that tip.
And do you do a lot of historical research, or have you done a lot of it before you embarked on this journey?
Yeah, I did as much as I could. But, as you might imagine, for a 7-year trip, there's only so much you can pack in. So I'm also researching as I go along. I'm doing what you, Kathleen, or any other reporter does, which is I report as I go. I do interviews with historians. I talk to experts and then read books and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Well, think of all of the books. You've got probably 50 books right now. Imagine how many books you're going to have in your head by the time this is over.
Now, that's one of the great advantages of walking through the world in the 21st century, right? Because they're all digital and they don't weigh anything except electrons.
Exactly. Has anybody ever attempted doing this? Are you doing a first kind of journey, Paul?
Well, there are people, in fact, a growing number of people who are embarked on extremely long foot journeys around the world. There's an acquaintance of mine, a very fine fellow from Canada, who walked, I believe, 45,000 kilometers over the space of 11 years. But, what I have to also keep reminding readers is that that's not the primary purpose of my particular project. I don't, walking, while central in some senses to the project, to kind of retrace this kind of Pleistocene Stone Age mindset of the people that I'm trying to follow, it's more a vehicle to tell stories. So I'm not an athlete. I'm not out to set some world record
right
about walking. In fact, I could care less about that. And that's why I'm not measuring things about, I'm not, that's not what interests me. But there are, as far as I know, nobody's taken this particular route, kind of using DNA technology and fossil evidence to kind of rewalk the pathways of our ancestors.
Yeah. Well, I must say, your pictures and your writing have just been extraordinary. So I hope you hear that.
Thank
I don't know how often you have contact with people here. It must be a little bit lonely.
Thank you.
But they're absolutely extraordinary. And Paul, all the best to you. I hope we can talk next year.
You bet. Yeah. It should be maybe by India the next time we chat.
Okay, Paul. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Paul Salopek, go to our Facebook page and you can figure out all the ways, because there are many that you can see his photographs and interviews with people he's met along the way. He's been on the journey for a year and a half already, but he'll will be on the journey for 7 years. Isn't that remarkable? Paul is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. He's been a foreign correspondent in Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, Latin America, and he's a National Geographic Fellow as well. Pictures are worth looking at. Well, thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP for on-air production, and to Cynthia Schuster.